Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. And we are pleased to welcome back to the program Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She also teaches at the U of I College of Medicine here in Urbana-Champaign. She is here every other month. It's always a Monday, and we talk about women's health. And in part, the idea is that she comes prepared to talk about things that might be new, but also it is here, as all of our healthcare programs are, here as a resource for you to ask questions. Now, I always try to caution people that, of course, we can't do diagnosis over the telephone. There are some limits as to what we can do. But if you have basic kinds of questions and you're trying to understand, and we hope that these programs will add to people's understanding about health, so please do take the opportunity here to call, and I know that the doctor will do her best to answer your question. And then, of course, if you have further concerns, you may need to pursue that with someone who can see you. But this is a place you can start if you want to ask questions. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Good to see you once again. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Good morning.
I have this feeling I haven't seen you in a long time.
I know. We do it every other month instead of a month late now.
All right. Well,
time passes.
We already have somebody here who's ready to go, so great. We'll get right to this caller in Belgium, not too far away from her, over by Danville. Not the country. She's giving me this funny look. Line number four, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I must say that usually I don't listen to this program. However, a few of us fellows were sitting around a card game a couple of days ago, and a conversation came up. All of us have wives who are pretty much into menopause. And the question was to each other, says, well, how does menopause start? Is it because the women run out of cells to produce eggs with, or the hormones change first? Is it the chicken comes first, or does the egg come first, you know?
Well, it's an excellent question because a lot of people do think of menopause as a sort of tank of estrogen gas, and then when you run out of that estrogen, you're symptomatic. But you've hit the nail exactly on the head that it is linked, in fact, with how many eggs are in the ovary. And a female fetus probably has about 4 million eggs when the ovary is formed. By the time that female fetus is born, there are only 1 million eggs. She's already lost 3/4 of all of her eggs. And in her lifetime, she will then ovulate about 400 times. And in fact, when she's completely run out of eggs to ovulate, she has officially reached the time of menopause, which we've given it a definition of one full year with no menstrual periods. So one full year of no ovulation and no more eggs being awake is the formal medical definition of menopause. But there are hormonal changes that do accompany this decrease in number of ovulations. And before the eggs completely quit ovulating, they function poorly. And so they aren't necessarily ripening to full ovulation, and the hormonal sequence that's occurring in the ovary isn't necessarily exactly like it was in the woman's 20s and 30s. And so in actuality, as a woman goes through perimenopause, the time leading up to menopause, her estrogen levels might be quite high or quite low. But if you kind of compared an everyday average, those months are generally lower, but the peaks and valleys can actually be more dramatic.
Oh, my. So it sounds like it's pretty complicated.
It is. Men don't run out of sperm in their whole lives. They make new sperm batches about every 120 days. So there is such a thing as a male menopause, but it occurs much, much later in life.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. So just, I want to make sure I understand it as kind of the where the caller framed it. Is it the case that, in fact, at a certain point that the ovaries, they have a way of sensing what their egg supply is, and then the ovary sends some kind of signal to where it is the hormone
the
is produced,
eggs,
and that?
Yes, the eggs themselves that are awakening will send hormonal signals to the brain, and the brain will start doing different things. And the ovary itself runs out of a hormone called inhibin that we don't talk about very much, but actually now can be measured clinically. So if somebody wants to know what their egg supply is, we can measure a level of inhibin B, and that will give us some idea of whether or not she's crossing over into menopause. It's kind of the new way to measure menopause rather than just getting FSH levels. But yes, it's this poor egg supply that's sending on brain signals that lead to hormonal changes, but it's in fact running out of the eggs.
Okay. And that's, and as you say, the difference, one of the differences between men and women is that women are born with all the eggs they're ever going to have.
Correct.
Men continue to produce new sperm. The sperm production and testosterone levels are going to go down some as men get older.
Really older.
But it goes out there. And so, but then it is at the time of menopause, ovaries, they still will have eggs
right
in
at the,
them.
Maybe or, most, if you did a biopsy of a woman's ovaries who's, say, 80 years old, you will not find any eggs at all. If you did a biopsy of a, say, 50-year-old woman's ovary, you would find some remaining egg cells, but probably fewer and farther between. And then some people, they've completely now run out. They're dead. There's no more to be found. They're atrophic.
And when in ovulation, it goes one side, the other, one side 1 month, the other side?
It does alternate, but most women ovulate about 80% of the time on their right ovary. We don't know why that is. There's a theory that we have a little bit better blood supply to our right ovary than our left ovary because of the way our anatomy is, mm-hmm. but we don't really know why that is.
And how many eggs on average in one ovulation, how many eggs get released?
A group of eggs wakes up about the third week of the cycle before, but then because of hormonal signaling between the eggs, only one emerges the victor. But when we give hormone therapy, the reason we get twins and triplets and so forth is that we override that for fertility purposes. We override some of those signals and more than one egg wakes up. But so a handful of eggs is used up in each cycle. And in some people, it varies. In some people, it may be 3 or 4. In some people, it may be 10 or 12. In some people, it may be 20 or 30. Mm. It's usually at least several.
Mm. Well, all right. We have some other callers here. Let's go next to Champagne. They're both Champagne, but first we'll go to line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello. Hi.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I work for a pretty large company, and a colleague of mine, a woman, has recently become pregnant, which she shared with her colleagues, you know. We both have engineering, computer-aided engineering jobs, which means we sit in front of pretty large, top-of-the-line computer monitors all day to give us the graphics we need. She was nervous about this and requested from our large company flat screen monitor. This might be appropriate discussion. I mean, because getting into which type of computer monitor. I was wondering if you had any information about whether she's right that a flat screen computer is safer than the old big CRT that are very wide, the very large monitors.
There have been some studies looking at this, and as you and probably your employers know, that whatever information there is available to the public can be reached, excuse me, at government websites like the FDA website and National Institute of Health websites do maintain listings. And by law, if a patient, if a person works for a company, say, for instance, if a company is handling certain chemicals, by law, that employer has to provide what is or is not known about the safety of working with those chemicals for pregnant individuals. And that would apply to jobs around, say, with power lines, around magnets, around radiation. You know, we have X-ray techs that have to wear protection that still are at a little bit of risk. And in a field like yours, you're right, I don't know the exact differences between all the screens, but they have done some studies looking at pregnant moms working in front of computers, because that is quite common. But you're right, different types of screens, they may not have of always controlled for that in the studies, and as the screens change and the amounts of various kinds of radiation, so forth, that they may or may not emit may change. But most of the initial studies that sort of swirled around the internet that made it look like that there was a slight increased risk of miscarriage weren't done very well. And you have to understand that in our population, of eggs that are ovulated, about 80% are destined to miscarry. And of eggs that...
80?
Oh,
my God.
Most cases are destined for miscarriage. And we didn't used to know about most of these cases because we didn't have, you know, the rabbit had to die. The reason rabbit had to die is we had to kill it to find out, you know, the effects of the pregnant woman's urine. So obviously the newfangled home pregnancy tests have changed our knowledge about this considerably. So of patients who get a positive home pregnancy test, probably at least one-third to one-fourth of those patients are doomed to miscarry. So you have to have a dramatic effect of something to show a difference in miscarriage rate. Same with birth defects. About 3% of our 2 to 3% of our population is born with some sort of birth defect. Again, you have to have a major effect by something, and it's tricky to do these studies. We're not going to round up, you know, two groups of women and figure out, you know, who's going to miscarry. But I mean, bottom line, off the top of my head, don't know of anything specific about the monitor she's being exposed to, but that information is definitely available from either her employer or from the company or from the FDA or the NIH. There's also places like Columbia University has a very good toxicology center. Okay. There are two or three websites, don't remember them off the top of my head, that in some of them you can't get access to all their data without belonging, you know, one of those. But there are places that keep a lot of good information for you guys about that.
Okay, yeah, the employer is looking into it, and I'll look at those websites you mentioned. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And let's go on to another caller here, and this is Champagne in line two. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I have a question about medical menopause or surgical menopause.
Okay.
If somebody, I have a friend who lost her first ovary and her uterus at, I think she was 37 or 38, and then when she was 45, she lost the second ovary surgically. But she had endometriosis, and she thinks she still cycles some because she still gets pain at certain times of the month. They can't always get all of those cells. So I was wondering if that's possible, that she could still be cycling, or that she could have been cycling after losing both her ovaries.
With complete ovarian removal, it's not possible to actually have menstrual cycles. It is something that can be tested. She can have certain hormone tests. Sometimes ultrasounds are useful, but it is something that she can go to her own gynecologist and try to be evaluated to whether or not she has what's been termed the ovarian remnant syndrome. And it is exactly what it sounds like. Some ovary has actually been left. And you're right, in certain conditions, infections, even some cancers, endometriosis, certain other kinds of adhesive disease in the pelvis, it is not necessarily possible to remove every microscopic bit of the ovary. And at a fairly young age, which 45, relatively young, some women can still cycle with very small amounts of the ovary left, which is why if you want to retain an ovary and you have, say, a big cyst, it's fairly easy to retain some ovary that will be reasonably functional. So bottom line, yes, it's possible, but she should probably be evaluated by her physician, because if she has a condition that warranted complete ovarian removal, she may need to be monitored a little bit differently than if she had a condition that She had ovaries removed electively. And up until a couple of years ago, we used to electively remove ovaries fairly routinely when women were over the age of 40. But nowadays, we've bumped that age up to about 65. And if you have no reason to lose your ovaries prior to 65, we have people keep them. So things have been changing quite a bit in that area of medicine.
No, this was not elective. All right. Well, thank you for the information.
All right. And we'll go on again to Urbana. This is line number three. Hello.
Hello. Is that me?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Yes. I have a question about smoking. I don't know if is that something you can talk about?
I can certainly try.
I have a female friend in her mid-50s who stopped smoking several months back, and now she suffers from dry coughing, hacking, extended spells. What can you tell me about this, about the risks, what you should do?
And when we talk about people who are smokers, we talk about what's called pack years.
Okay.
And so one pack a day for one full year is one pack year. Would you have any clue of this theoretical individual, how many pack years of smoking?
I know she's been smoking less in recent years.
Yeah.
But I would guess probably maybe 15 or 20 pack years, something like that.
Well, individuals who have long pack year histories from smoking can have a variety of chronic lung conditions that can occur over time. Emphysema and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease are two. They also are more susceptible to chronic bronchitis. Also, individuals who live in our area are somewhat susceptible to certain chronic pulmonary problems. There's certain funguses that exist in our fields. If we get exposed, we can develop chronic lung conditions. Also, coughing does not necessarily have to be a lung condition, and consequences of smoking don't have to necessarily be lung conditions. They can be a consequence of the esophagus, or any of the nasal oral passages can have problems that can lead to dry hacking cough. So, for instance, you get postnasal drip is a common cause of conditions like that. So it is possible that there was something going on with her smoking. Perhaps she had no nasal mucus and now she has some, and it's somewhat irritating. But anybody who has a chronic hacking cough does need to see their primary care physician and try to establish the base of it, basic symptomatic things. If you Google it on the internet, they'll tell you to do things like hydrate better, get more rest, get more sleep. Some of the simple kinds of things that can be done. There are salt, like ocean mist nasal type sprays and things like that to moisturize some of the nasal passages that sometimes help. But really, bottom line, if it's been weeks or months, probably needs to see her primary care doctor.
She saw the primary care doctor, and as she phrased it, he just shrugged his shoulders. That is, apparently he did not know had no idea what was going on.
Well, again, I don't know what occurred, and we're not treating anybody over the phone here, but in general, usually what a primary care approach is to evaluate that there's not something serious. And if there's not something serious, give it a little bit more time, because many of these things do just go away on their own. But if it persists, then probably another consultation's warranted.
Is a pulmonary doctor recommended at some point?
Pulmonary doctors and ENTs. Pulmonary evaluate the lung. ENTs evaluate the nasooral passages.
What's an ENT?
Yep. ENT, ear, nose, and throat doctor.
Sure. Okay.
We only speak in code.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Others are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Our guest is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She's an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She also teaches at U of I Med School here in Urbana-Champaign. She has a private practice in our area. And every other month she's here, we talk about women's health, try to concentrate specifically on those things that she spends most of her time with. And, of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. One of the things that over time, particularly probably over the last, 20 years, we've talked a lot about is osteoporosis. And one of the things that you have talked about when women are trying to think about, what their condition is, what their risk is, and then what to do about it. One of the things that would be good to know is if you're concerned about the future of your bones, you'd like to know, well, how are they doing right now? To get some sort of baseline to then decide, what do we need to do anything, and when do we do that? And there are probably some variety of ways to try to do that, to get some idea. Some of them may be more precise, some of them may be less precise, but it may also be the case that the more precise ones are going to be more involved and going to be more expensive. What now is the recommendation about, well, what kind of ways you can do approach this bone density issue?
Well, what's a good way to think about it is what is the definition of osteoporosis? And osteoporosis is a bone disease that is that your bones are compromised such in their strength that there's an increased risk of fracture. And we know, we talk a lot about it in respect to menopause because we know that certain bones in certain locations are a little bit more predisposed to losing their bone mass faster, being more compromised in their strength, and being more at risk to fracture. However, bone strength has two different aspects to it. One is the actual thickness of that bone, and the other is the quality of that bone. And we know that the thickness of the bone represents about 75% of the strength, but the quality represent at least 25% of the strength. So that when we do a typical bone density test, we're talking thickness, and that's a good test to get, and it measures the just how thick you are, and because of that, it gives us a statistical prediction as to how likely or not likely you are to fracture, and we use that to base decisions on whether or not you need therapy or what you need to do to preserve your bone health. But we've never really nailed down this bone quality piece. Now, when we do research studies, some people volunteer to have bone biopsies to look at their actual quality under a microscope. But that is expensive, and that is painful. And I really applaud anybody that's ever done that because it's a very difficult thing to do and not something that can be done clinically. We look indirectly at quality, looking at bone turnover, like in your blood or urine. And we know that if you are turning bone over very, very fast, the quality can be somewhat compromised. So we look at that. Bone ultrasound tests where we, you know, at a health fair, you might have your heel bone density done. That's actually usually done with an ultrasound type test. And it's called a QUS, quantitative ultrasound. And that actually measures quality a little bit, but there's some problems with those machines because they're kind of quick and dirty machines. So they can be transported. And your heel takes some pounding and might have some bone quality issues that the rest of your body might not have. And really the major way of measuring bone quality is to do a CAT scan. But as you know, CAT scans are a way of doing x-rays in the round, essentially, to get a 3D view. And they're very precise, very accurate, but they've always been very expensive. And now we're trying to come up with a way to maybe get a CAT scan of your actual wrist to be able to look at the quality. One research group has been doing that, and it's not available clinically yet, but it's going to be something that's available. And what's important for listeners to know who've had bone density tests is that number is only one piece of the puzzle, and that there are other pieces of the puzzle that sometimes need to be fit in before we can really make good recommendations for long-term therapy.
We have some other callers here. Let's go to someone in Champaign, and this would be line number one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
I have a question about polycystic ovarian syndrome, and I guess I'm wondering if Dr. Trooping can talk about how PCOS can interrupt the rest of the cycle post-ovulation if someone is trying to get pregnant.
Okay, well, polycystic ovarian condition is a variety of things. The people who have the full blown, they have ovaries that are very cystic, so lots of eggs trying to mature at once and being a little bit confused about which egg is going to go on to ovulate. We were talking about this a little bit earlier, so that one doesn't necessarily emerge from the pack, but they all stay very partially awake so that the ovaries, if you look at them under ultrasound, look more like Swiss cheese rather than just say one follicle that's developing to ovulate. It usually also has adrenal problems, so some male hormone level abnormalities. Usually in full-blown cases, there's problems with the insulin metabolism, so people are more likely to become diabetic, they're more likely to have high cholesterol, they're more likely to have hypertension, they're more likely to have what's called hirsutism, some abnormal hair growth. It could be on the face, it could be on the upper chest, or it could be on your chin. That's the full bone. In the milder cases, it may just be something where you happen to have an ultrasound, your ovary looks a little bit cystic, but you've never missed a period in your life. You have no abnormal hormone levels. You have no abnormal hair growth. It's just a very mild. Most people fit somewheres in between. And so it depends on where an individual is in that whole spectrum of polycystic ovaries that determines whether you just have polycystic ovaries or the whole syndrome or what some people have termed the disease. Well, that's putting a whole lot of information very, very simplistically. So until you really know where you are, it's hard for somebody to really predict whether or not that's going to affect your ability to ovulate and conceive. So that for most women, we say, try to get pregnant. And if you conceive, good, you're done. If you're having cycles that are too long, and by definition, we say that a normal cycle would be every 21 to 35 days. So if your cycles are stretching out past 35 days, you're getting periods every 6 weeks, every 8 weeks, every 12 weeks, then that's called amenorrhea if it gets above 12 weeks. And it's also probably linked with either what we call oligoovulation, not ovulating enough, or anovulation, not ovulating at all. And if someone is not ovulating frequently, it's going to take them longer to conceive, but they'll probably do it on their own. If they're really not ovulating at all, they need to get some help. And that is, it's the ovulation that's then linked to the type of hormones that the ovary is going to produce that is going to be linked to what the other consequences of polycystic ovarian disease are past just ovulation.
Okay. So, I mean, I'm sorry. I'm trying to understand.
I know. It's really complicated.
So, because I've been diagnosed with some form of PCOS, and it sounds like I'm in between.
Okay.
And for the last couple of cycles, and they're treating me for high testosterone levels, and that's been lowered already. And I've actually been ovulating for the last couple of cycles, but haven't been able to get pregnant. And so I'm just wondering if PCOS does anything to their hormone levels that would affect the actual ability of a sperm to, you know, penetrate an egg.
Probably not. The abnormal hormone levels of polycystic ovarian condition have more to do with whether or not you're really ovulating.
Okay.
Now, it's only, you probably don't truly know if you're ovulating or not. You're probably looking at various signs like having a menstrual period or having a twinge of a pain.
Well, I've also been doing the test.
Mm-hmm. The LH test.
Yeah, the LH.
Which is, all of those are what we call indirect measures.
Okay.
So the LH is a hormone produced by the brain that signals the ovary to release a fertile egg. But you don't truly know if your egg is really there and fertile. But as long as the egg is there and fertile, it's possible that some hormone levels affect tubal transport of sperm. But if the fertile egg is there and the sperm are there in reasonable numbers, it shouldn't be anything that would have a consequence of not allowing that sperm to fertilize the egg.
Okay.
What they would probably do is suspect that, in fact, you're not actually producing a fertile egg each month.
Even though I'm on the ovulation prediction kit, it's showing that it does. So I might need some other testing?
Yes. But okay. Remember, we're not treating anybody over the phone.
Right. I'm just trying to figure out, like, if this is, you know, if I need to go in.
Well, here's the thing is,
about more tests.
And here's some numbers that you might want to think about. If couples are out there trying to have sex and get pregnant, about 1/3 of couples are pregnant at the end of 3 months, and about 60% of couples are at the end of pregnant at the end of 6 months, and about 80% are pregnant at the end of 1 year. So just a couple of cycles isn't really a fair shot at it yet.
Okay.
It takes longer than that to really determine. It may just be by law of odds. The other thing is important to remember that we've always said that eggs live for about 24 hours and that sperm live for about 72. And that's where we get this, you know, have sex every other day stuff when you're trying to get pregnant. But since some women, their eggs may not live quite that long, or nor the sperm might not live that long. And it turns out that you're more likely to get pregnant if the sperm is there first, before the egg's released.
Okay.
So that having sex early is better than, you know, an egg might be there and alive, but apparently the sperm have trouble making it there and doing their job if they get there second instead of first. So, you know, things like that may affect your actual pregnancy rate.
Okay. So one last question. So what kind of testing can I ask a doctor to do to find out if I'm actually ovulating?
Well, I think most physicians would recommend an infertility consult and to sit down and kind of go over what you've done, what other factors may or may not be contributing. Is there a tubal factor? Is the sperm count good? Is the mucus fertile enough when you're ovulating? So there are a number of factors they would probably consider in addition before going on to some of the more sophisticated tests, which are watching the ovary with an ultrasound and doing hormone levels and things like that.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. We'll go on here. We have a caller here in Champaign County. This is line number 2. Hello.
Hi there. Mm-hmm. I actually had a question about any possible new birth control methods. I think you did a clinical with Depo-Provera injections, which I wanted to ask about. But on the last subject, I'm just remembering I had a non-scientific report that eating yams, do you know anything about dietary estrogen and increased fertility in women?
You're mixing apples and oranges with your yams.
You were just talking about this.
Yams are the a certain type of Mexican yam is a raw source of a hormone substance that can be made in the laboratory into progesterone, and that eating yams we lack that chemical step in our body that can turn the substance into yams into a progesterone. So no matter what you read anywhere, no. Yams cannot become birth control no matter how many you eat. Nor
Excuse me, I'll have to interrupt because I was actually asking question follow-up to the last, which was increased fertility. I have a further question about anything to do with actual birth control.
Sure.
So I don't want you to. I wasn't suggesting that yams or birth control. I was suggesting the opposite, but I don't know if.
Right. The opposite's not true either. There are certain plant estrogens called phytoestrogens in a variety of foods, and there is a condition that grazed animals that eat too much clover have actually fewer ovulations. So not increased fertility, decreased fertility if they take in too much plant estrogen, that it works like a birth control pill. So to answer your question, it works the opposite, not to increase, but to decrease your fertility.
And is there any, I think what the caller was saying, is there anything that you could say people could do in terms of their diet that might, if they're trying to get pregnant, that there's anything that you could do with diet that would help?
Nothing specific. We know that people who are on very calorie-restricted diets are less likely to ovulate. Anorexic people, for instance. But within the realm of normal foods and normal vitamin intake and normal exposure to estrogens and that sort of thing in our foods, not that I know,
no.
not anything that I know of that would specifically work to increase fertility. Now, we do know that if you have better cervical mucus around the time that you ovulate, it increases your fertility. And simple things like cough syrup do actually improve the cervical mucus, but that's like a chemical that wouldn't be part of your diet.
Okay. And now, if I could ask about the...
what's new in contraception?
Yeah, contraceptive. Is there new? And am I recollecting that you did do something with Epoprovera?
Yes. I've probably done contraceptive studies for over 20 years now. And with Epoprovera, I was in the 7-year study that specifically was looking at bone density changes over time. And so we weren't so much at that juncture looking at contraceptive effectiveness. There's also a new dose of Depo-Provera available. It's 104 milligrams instead of the 150 milligrams. And I was in a study looking specifically at its effectiveness for treatment of endometriosis as well as ovulation suppression. So I was in that study. I also was in the study that looked at Lunel, which was a great product. It is available worldwide still, but not in the United States. And it's a combination with a little bit of estrogen and a little bit of progesterone, which Depo-Provera just has progesterone. But there were some manufacturing problems with it when it was initially withdrawn from the marketing. They were doing single dose vials that had a little bit of quality control with the dosing. And so they stopped the manufacture, and then the company was bought out by another drug company who'd never taken it off the shelf for whatever reason.
If I have another follow-up, what about a non-systemic? The whole idea of injecting something to the whole body or even taking a pill, are there any hormonal IUDs or, I know, spermicidal rings and, I mean...
Well, there's the new Esure, which are coils that can be placed in the fallopian tubes under local anesthesia, a process that takes about 6 to 10 minutes to do, but it's permanent. There are some other frameless IUDs that are being studied that will become very easy to place and possibly even just sort of wear off their usefulness over time, so they don't really have to be removed. There is the new Mirena IUD. I say new, but it's been out for quite a number of years, and it leaks a little bit of progesterone locally, so that enhances its effectiveness and also is a very good control of irregular bleeding. There are several new cervical caps that are under development. One of the big areas of research right now, it's not something that I'm working on. We're working more with birth control pills, changing cycles. We have one study that's going to be the newest, lowest possible dose of hormone in a birth control pill. But out there, some of the research is looking at what's called microbial sides. So not when we use nonoxynol 9 or any kind of spermicide, the main effect is to kill sperm, and a side effect is that it kills off some microbes as well. But now they're working on microbicide development, whereas the main effect would be to protect you from getting diseases, but a side effect would be that it kills off sperm as well. So microbicides, there's probably 10 or 12 of those in development right now. I've heard that one is kind of making it through, and that's been somewhat helpful. But you're right, still hormonal kinds of solutions are what's mostly out there. There's a new rod implant that's a single rod that will leak a little bit of progesterone. The advantages of it being implanted like that is it's there. You don't have to do health behaviors. So that seems to help in effectiveness. But that's pretty much what is new.
What is there any website? I've looked a little bit, and I can't seem to find the right keyword on any of these. Is there any place that
talks about all the research? There's lots of good ones. The Population Council has a pretty good website that talks about a lot of development in contraception. ARHP, the Association of Reproductive Health Professionals, and it's ARHP.org, I think, has an area where they talk about research and development. If you go to the FDA site, if you also go to, there's a very good place called CenterWatch that is an area that advertises what kind of studies are done, and they list all the government studies as well as other drug trials enrolling, and a lot of centers do have listings on that site that stay pretty current.
Okay. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Dr. Suzanne Truppin. She's an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She's with us every other month. We talk about women's health, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Next is our Urbana, line one.
Oh, good morning, Dr. Truppin. I have osteoporosis, and I've been taking Fosamax once a week. Now, I understand there's another medication that you can take once a month that's similar to that. Is it? I don't remember the name. Is it Boniva?
Yes.
Okay. I discussed it with my internist, and his take on it was that he felt that the once a month one might not be as effective for strengthening the bones of the spine as Fosamax. So I was wondering what your take on that is.
Well, Fosamax is a bisphosphonate, and all bisphosphonates work very, very similarly. Fosamax was the first bisphosphonate on the market, so there is the longest amount of information on the market about that. The way they did the Boniva drug study, their information was done on once-a-day medication, and then they did a once-a-month study, and they proved to the FDA they call it a bridging. There's these certain terms. They proved to the FDA that the once a month did as well as bone density as the once a day, and that allows their drug to become marketed. So not all drugs actually are powered in terms of their study with a fracture endpoint. So that's why you don't have as much fracture data on some of these medicines as other medicines. And so that for somebody who really can't tolerate and once a month is a much easier medicine, and if they have good response to the medication, which we certainly can follow over time with bone density, the once a month is a great solution. Just as an aside, Boniva also comes as a 4 times a year injectable. So for people who cannot swallow a bisphosphonate, there are alternatives as well.
Okay, thank you. One more question. I've also heard that both Fosamax and Synthroid, which I take, robs the bone of density. Is there an...
Well, no, Fosamax should add density or at least maintain density, but a thyroid medication, there are a whole list of medications that can actually affect your bone. For instance, steroid use, it's gotten to the point where the American Rheumatology Association has recommended that when people are on courses of steroids, that they be given Fosamax. We don't do it to children usually, but to even, you know, any adults. So, yes, definitely medication can affect your bone health. And that doesn't mean you can be taken off your Synthroid. You got to take your thyroid medicine.
Right. Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Bye. And we'll go to line two for someone else here. This is Champagne. Line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question regarding premenopausal symptoms. I am getting my menstrual cycle twice a month now, and I'm in my late 40s, and I was wondering if that's a premenopausal symptom or not.
Menstrual cycle change is usually one of the first changes that we do see as women lead into menopause. The current term is perimenopausal change,
okay.
And anything shorter than a 21-day cycle is considered abnormal and probably should be evaluated by a gynecologist for other causes of bleeding, so that we count from day one of the first menstrual period to day one of the next menstrual period. So if you still have 21 days, you can sometimes get two periods in one calendar month, but it actually would be considered normal. But if month after month that's occurring, you may need to be evaluated. There are lots of causes of irregular bleeding in women in their 40s. For instance, polyps or thickening of the lining or cervical abnormalities. And most of these things can be detected by a basic pelvic exam, with or without a pap smear if it's indicated, and sometimes ultrasound exams. Sometimes anovulation can lead to cyst formation, which can be picked up on pelvic exam or ultrasound. So there are a lot of simple causes that can explain period changes as well as just going through menopause.
Does that
get it? Okay,
all right, very good. We have a couple minutes left here, and certainly if somebody else wants to call, we can get another caller. I know there was one other thing you thought you might talk a little bit about, and that was, I guess, about non-hormonal treatments for hot flashes.
Well, you know, when the Women's Health Initiative came out, many women just went ahead and stopped their hormone therapy. And the current, if we had to summarize, which, you know, sometimes hard to put a lot of information into a couple of sentences, but if we had to summarize, we say that we would like women to use the lowest effective estrogen dose for the shortest amount of time, and that only women who are truly symptomatic should be considered with hormone therapy, and only women with moderate to severe symptoms should be considered for hormone therapy, and to try other strategies if your symptoms are mild. So there's been a whole host of various kinds of things that are tried. We've come to understand that the hot flashes and things that women are experiencing probably have something to do with our brain and how we regulate the hormones, the inner brain signals like serotonin, norepinephrine, dopamine, and that estrogen directly affects that, which is why it works so well to control hot flashes in people with them. We also have come to learn that women who have symptoms have a little bit different brain physiology than women who don't have symptoms. And that's why some compounds might work that are other than estrogen. So most of the interest has been targeted around the various antidepressants like Prozac and Zoloft, because it turns out that especially for the first month that people are on those medicines, they really notice a tremendous amount of benefit for their hot flashes. But it's also true that most people, that effect does not last. So lots of times I see people in who talk about, well, I either don't want to take estrogen because of the long-term risks of heart disease or blood clots, or I was taken off of estrogen because of my doctor's recommendations. And what else can I do? And these antidepressants have been pretty much what we've turned to. Some people have tried herbal solutions like black cohosh or the red clover, which I mentioned in the fertility discussion. And again, slight benefit, but really not a good solution long term for very many people. And so we've tried various other anti-seizure medicines, various other kinds of medicines. And so we're continuing in our hunt, and turns out that one of the newer antidepressants that has effects on both the SSRI, the serotonin system in the brain, as well as the norepinephrine system in the brain, might be the best solution that we've found yet that isn't estrogen. And one thing that I've been interested in, not even so much how to get people treated, but then how do you get them off? And that's been one of the bigger problems, is how do you wean people off? And so we're finally starting to do some studies looking not only at successful therapy, but successful end to that successful therapy. Yes. And that's the newest direction research is taking.
Well, it sounds like, though, that maybe the thing that's a little frustrating is that really nothing works as well as
right.
Estrogen
so
does.
So far.
Well, and there's good reason to have concern now because of the studies that you mentioned about long-term, very long-term hormonal replacement. What, though, is how much risk attaches to the lowest possible dose of hormone that you could get by with, and let's say for a year?
Oh, yeah. They've pretty much shown that up to the first 5 years, mm-hmm. the Women's Health Initiative showed that up to the first 5 years, there's probably almost minimal risk unless somebody has something like an active estrogen-dependent neoplasia cancer, something like that. So, yes, those first 5 years, very, very minimal risk. But, you know, most people get from, say, their late 40s to their early 50s, there's still a huge percentage of the population that's symptomatic in their early 50s. And it's not until we get into our 80s where we see the huge percentage of the population not symptomatic anymore. So we're also looking at these SERMs. We're doing two different studies looking at selective estrogen receptor modulators, which some people have nicknamed designer estrogens, which Avista is one, Tamoxifen is a SERM. These things are known to work on bone health, but we're trying to look at SERMs that might work for other things that estrogen works for. So, for instance, the vaginal atrophy and dryness, we've seemed to found a couple of SERMs that may work for that so that you could get a local treatment of estrogen, or you could try one of these SERMs that will also benefit your bone. So we're trying to get that magical molecule that'll have the best of two worlds for patients.
Well, I guess for this time around, we'll say thanks very much.
Thank you.
To our guest, Dr. Suzanne Troopen. She's professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the U of I Med School here in Urbana-Champaign. She also has a practice here in our area. And every other month now, she's here to talk about women's health. And so we will see her again in January.
Right? Next year.
All right, next year. Thanks very much.